Everybody back from their respective addictions. Okay, yeah.
So, rearticulation of the terms that are still up there from the bourgeois value system to the socialist value system. It's a conceptual shift, right? I mean, it's different concepts that have the same terms attached to them. So freedom in the bourgeois conception of freedom is different from the socialist conception of freedom.
Right, but it's not that they're not intersecting. But it's not, this is not an Orwellian move. That is Orwell, you know, in 1984, the Orwellian manipulation of language turns words into their opposites. So freedom means slavery. Right? The argument of articulation is that there is overlapping meaning. There's something in the bourgeois notion of freedom that also is in the socialist notion of freedom. They both have a notion of the autonomous person that should be respected. Right. There is a core, and this is, I think, also Marx's view, there's a core achievement in the capitalist era that can be described as a moral achievement in the progress of humanity, you know, to use the teleological sort of imagery that sometimes Marx used. There was a core achievement, and one notion was the freeing of people from the bonds of ascriptive oppressions. You know, no longer matters whether you're black or white, male or female. Marx had this idea, as in a way similar to Weber, that what capitalism did is break the chains of status ascription and create the free individual, but capitalism then cripples this achievement by tying it to private property and the market. So what, in that view, what socialism does is realizes the kernel of the value of freedom that is already present in capitalism, but liberates it from the bonds of its bad articulation. And that's different from saying that socialist notions of freedom are completely incommensurable with capitalist notions of freedom. They overlap, but that overlap gets obscured by the inappropriate subordination of freedom to private property in the capitalist configuration. And that's something you can point out to people. So the idea here is, you could take somebody that buys into bourgeois ideology, and if you have a good and open and intelligent discussion, you can show them what the implications are of so tightly subordinating freedom to private property, and that actually what they care about freedom doesn't depend upon that connection. That what really they care about, the real value that a freedom-loving person cares about, is self-determination, the ability of people to shape their own projects and lives. And then you show that the subordination to private property actually interferes with that. Now, some people are going to find that interesting and troubling, and then they're going to have internal dialogues, and other people are going to say, bullshit, you know, what are you talking about? But that's the perspective of rearticulation.
So more generally, beliefs and therefore ideology in general is conceptual, right? I mean, they're all types of concepts, and they interplay in conceptual ways.
Yeah, beliefs are things that you can consciously invoke in your mind. So okay.
I was gonna say maybe Isaac Berlin's two conceptions of freedom or liberty. But then I thought maybe not. You know, freedom to and freedom from. Freedom to do something and freedom from.
Right.
But
yeah.
It might be, I don't know if there's a tie-in there.
There is a tie-in. In the philosophical discussions, there's a variety of ways that people have tried to tap these sets of issues. One is freedom to and freedom from. Sometimes it's called positive and negative freedom. Philippe Antoris draws the distinction between, he calls it real freedom. All of these attempts to parse the concept have difficulties, and that's why philosophers are paid to do their work. It turns out that freedom to always implies freedom from. So they're not exactly alternatives. That is, the freedom to do something does imply that people aren't interfering with your ability to do it.
Yeah.
Right? So it's not as if you can have freedom to without freedom from. And freedom from always means you can do some things. So it's not as neat as positive and negative freedom. But still, I find that a very useful way. The negative freedom is just blocking other people from telling you what to do, and positive freedom is being able to do things. You know, that seems straightforward enough. But it's not actually as straightforward as that when you push it. Yeah.
Well, I was just going to make the comment, but I think maybe the importance of that argument is that it can show how some of the concealment happens, right?
Right.
Because depending on which way you frame it, certain arguments become stronger than others.
Right. So in our discussion of hegemony, the tight subordination of this element to private property comes from the meaning of private property as rules that restrict the state control over that property and that protect that prevent other people from interfering with your property. That's what property rights means. Private property means a set of rules that restrict other people, particularly the state, but other persons, that's why we have laws against theft, from interfering with your property. So if freedom is subordinated to private property, if private property has its meaning from exclusions, from negative exclusions, then that tends to strengthen this negative notion of freedom rather than positive freedom.
Well, and also, when you frame it that way, the private property thing is like freedom from government involvement in your private property,
right.
But it obscures the fact that it limits freedom to do things in another sense.
Right.
I mean, you, so,
right.
Yeah.
Hi, Chuck.
I'll go on. I'm just thinking.
It's dangerous to think while moving one hand. I'm sure that there are other issues. If you're thinking about something, then think out loud about it. So.
I forgot basically to bring the article, so there was something that I wanted to ask about that issue, but I'm trying to remember that.
Okay.
So if I can remember, then
okay.
I will ask.
Matt.
You've talked about the theories that we have about the world being determined, at least in part, by past experience. And conversely, the things that we do to the world can change the material reality of the world, too. So, in a sense, there's objectivity in subjectivity, and there's subjectivity in objectivity. Or, in different terms, there's material within the ideational and ideational within the material.
Well, I don't know I'm not sure what the word within means in that context. That to say that the material conditions, these three components, the causal environment of choosing, the causal environment of the effects of actions, and the resources, may affect the internal states is an explanation. But I don't know if anything is added by saying that means these external conditions are internalize, are interior to, are within the ideational, within the beliefs. They help explain them.
Mm-hmm.
But what else do they do? What? I'm not sure what's added by that other language, which then, to me, makes it a little more obscure rather than clearer.
It might be, and in the spirit of thinking out loud, it might be the difference between explaining the beliefs and helping to constitute the beliefs.
And what's the constitution?
So, if I
explain,
like, if what I, well, I don't know, if I believe something based on prior experience, and if I had different prior experiences, I would believe something differently.
Right.
Then we can say that my beliefs are determined by material context to some degree.
Right.
So maybe it is the, you know, maybe it's just word semantics, I guess.
I think it's really important, if we can start using the words like determines and so on here. It is never the case that one can say external conditions determine one's beliefs. End of story. Because the person has to process whatever those external conditions are in the form of their experiences. And this expression, internal dialogue, is just one way of thinking about at least an important aspect of that processing. An important aspect of the processing by which your beliefs occurs through your conscious conversations with yourself. Not all. Some of the processing occurs unconsciously. So if you're a Freudian, you believe the unconscious processing of experience is the most important. If you're, you know, not so much a Freudian and more of a cognitive psychologist, you might believe that an awful lot of the formation of beliefs comes through internal dialogue. We then have, as a very interesting second-order discussion, what kinds of social contexts encourage the kind of internal dialogue within which beliefs can be formed more through this internal process and less as simply a consequence of these external constraints. In philosophical discussions, there's a language that's used here. It's another bit of jargon to put into your jargon map. The difference between autonomous and heteronomous belief formation. The word autonomous is familiar. Heteronomous is not such a familiar word. It's just, I don't know why they don't just say non-autonomous, but I guess it's a particular way of thinking about non-autonomy. That is, it's from outside the person. So the idea here is that not all beliefs are created equal. This is a kind of anti-relativist view. Not all beliefs are created equal. Some kinds of beliefs, including one's preferences, one's conscious purposes, some kinds of beliefs are formed in a rich environment where people learn how to autonomously engage in dialogue with themselves and sort out the different kinds of experiences and form their beliefs. People become skilled internal dialoguers, as it were. And some environments don't. And one thesis of contemporary sort of democratic theory is that the environments which create autonomous belief formation are environments which encourage collective problem solving and dialogue. That the way we learn to creatively and autonomously weigh and think through issues internally is by being in a community where respectfully and reciprocally people listen to each other and engage in interpersonal dialogue. This is the kind of Thomas Dewey pragmatist view of democracy, you know, that deliberative.
You mean John Dewey?
John Dewey. Did I say Thomas Dewey?
Yeah.
That's,
yeah. You said that earlier too.
That's really stupid. Thomas Dewey was the was the presidential candidate against the.
He wins.
Against Truman. Boy, that's him. Well, it just goes to show highfalutin professors can make stupid. Here's a criticism back. You should have corrected me the first time I said this idiotic. Came close.
I assumed it was somebody I hadn't.
You just snickered in the background. I would hate to deprive any good student of the opportunity to snicker in the background. It produces less rather than more embarrassment to the poor benighted faculty member to be corrected the first time they say something idiotic like that. Yeah. Okay. John Dewey. I think I actually made that error in print, but was caught by a copy editor once. So obviously this reflects a deeper problem. I do have a general problem with keeping names straight, as some of you will or have already figured out. This is just a manifestation of this learning disability. All right. In terms of belief formation, the Deweyan, I'll avoid the first name, the Deweyan pragmatistic idea is that democratic settings for deliberation are what he would call schools for democracy. They help form democratic citizens. And a democratic citizen is somebody who's not easily manipulated by propaganda and external charismatic figures because they're well practiced and schooled. They've got high capacity for creative problem solving in collective settings, which then helps them do so in their own internal subjective deliberations as well. This kind of perspective would say that mental capacities are really pivotal to this whole process, and mental capacities can be cultivated in certain kinds of social interactive settings in ways that create the possibility of the formation of different sorts of preferences, informations, and theories than would be possible in the absence of those mental capacities, particularly these problem-solving, deliberative capacities. Yeah.
Well, actually, how rational action takes place under pragmatism? Because if you revise your beliefs and the light of your experience, then you cannot be rationally guided by them.
No, I don't think, because problem solving itself can be driven by good reasons, evidence, and argument, rather than just by stereotyped and inflexible positions. The fact that you're revising your goals and that the means-end relationship is one that co-evolves does not mean that you don't provide reasons and evidence and argument which other people can dispute and change your views through this deliberative process. And that can be done in a way that I think satisfies principles of rationality. It's not narrowly instrumentally rational. The model of instrumental rationality is that you have fixed ends and then you choose the optimal means to achieve them. The kind of rationality that's involved in this pragmatist view is that what you have are an array of possible ends, some more central than some others, and some that you haven't figured out. And you have an array of possible resources that could be used to achieve those ends. But you want to fit the two together. That is, you want your resources to be used in the best possible way to achieve the most important of those ends that you either discover or form in the process of trying to apply the means to those ends, given a context where there's a problem that you're trying to solve. And a problem is something that's causing difficulties in people's lives. So the fact that all of these co-evolve through deliberation makes it much more complicated, less pat, and less clearly specified. But I don't think it means that the process becomes irrational or that the notion of rationality disappears. Certainly the notion of rationality as reasonableness is central to this. And even notions of efficiency. I mean, part of the reasons for the co-evolution of the means and ends is a desire not to waste resources, to squander them by using them effectively for the least important of our purposes. And the idea that you don't know what the most important of your purposes are because they're not fixed. The goals are not somehow given so clearly in the contexts where we live as social beings. And because the goals are complicated, mutually inconsistent, they're not nicely fixed, you have to discover them. And the act of discovering them actually transforms them. You know, you thought initially the goal was to clean up the lakes because you wanted to reduce health problems that happen with water pollution. And then you discover that that cleaner lakes allow for recreational possibilities, which will allow for families to be able to spend their Sundays picnicking on the lakeside and will help build community. And then you discover that actually what you really want to do is build community. That's what you were really unhappy about. And that the pollution problems from the lake were one of the things that were making everybody unhappy in the community. You know, so the goals, and then you discover there's some other things that will build community more than cleaning up the lake. So you shift your priorities after having suddenly realized that there's more in play than you initially thought. Now that is something you discover through deliberation about means and ends, where you don't treat the ends as already given and fixed. You see,
I just read an interesting article by Dewey about talking about the reflexivity between induction and deduction, and how that, I mean, there's an interplay there that he was talking about in a school setting, how, you know, don't teach deduction and induction and
right. It's a
similar.
It's obviously.
It's a similar
kind of idea that some people incorrectly, I think, draw the simple-minded conclusion from this that we have to get rid of all binaries, right? That means and ends no longer mean anything. We should get rid of the means-ends distinction. Well, that's just I think a wrong-headed response to this kind of complexity. No, you still have means to ends. There's still good and bad ways to accomplish things. That's not called into question by this complexity of the relationship of means and ends. What the complexity means is that you have to recognize that you have multiple ends, some of which you don't even realize initially, because you don't know exactly what's causing the problems and what you really want to achieve until you get down to business and try to pragmatically figure out the means to the ends. What are the ends that you want? Drift from one end to another as you clarify the issue, and that then invokes different means. So you still need means and ends, you still need these binaries, you still have induction and deduction. It's just that you don't regard these as rigidly separated, non-interacting, or fixed. Let's see, how did that come into the ideology? Oh, this had to do with the formation of the beliefs themselves, right? The beliefs that you form can be formed under these autonomous and less autonomous ways. This, by the way, there's a very big problem that comes up in a lot of progressive thinking about ideology and culture and the like, which centers around the ambiguities that occur once you drop moral absolutism. You know, once you believe that you don't have the answers to every question and that there's huge uncertainty in our moral judgments, the slippery slope to a kind of relativism where every belief is of equal value and you feel that it's insulting to pass judgment on other people's cultural standards. When I, in my book, Envisioning Real Utopias, invoke the notion of human flourishing as the kind of bedrock idea that I'm trying to realize, and the normative framework is to create the conditions in which all people have equal access to the necessary means to live a flourishing life, typically one response is, well, who are you to tell somebody what's a flourishing life, and isn't this just a Western, you know, modernist conception of a flourishing life rather than a peaceful life, you know, or a tranquil life rather than a flourishing life? Why is flourishing such a big deal? The Deweyan approach around dialogue, communication, and deliberation allows for at least a partial, if not solution, at least containment of that problem. So my view would be that under conditions of open dialogue and communication of equals, as people would attempt to solve problems that are affecting their lives, human flourishing would loom very large. I'm making a prediction, I'm making an empirical claim. It would loom very large as one of the goals that they would be attempting to accomplish through their use of collective resources through cooperation. It's not that it's the only thing that people would care about, but it would loom very large. That's an empirical claim. And that empirical claim basically then says, because the beliefs of actors under those conditions are formed in as autonomous a way as possible, fully respecting the internal processes of people, more than in other ways of forming beliefs, that provides some legitimacy to giving priority to those kinds of goals over others. Goals that are formed by autonomous deliberation with that kind of reflexivity have interpersonal stability. I mean, there's a whole lot of other stuff that goes into this. This is a sort of combination of Dewey and Habermas's way of trying to contain the problem of relativism, given that you are no longer treating moral standards as given by some authoritative text like a religion or something like that. This is one of the reasons why, in the end, the thesis that you should break down into small groups. See, when we break down into small groups, every one of you is talking intensively for a half hour, right? I mean, that's when we break down into small groups, everybody's talking. Because you all, which therefore means that, the empirical conclusion from that is you must have things to say. And it's the context which determines the extent to which you're prepared to say them.
Yeah, but that 3-second silence has never happened before in this class.
I think that's the longest space of silence
ever. Ever.
Okay.
Yeah, plus when you break down in groups sometimes, when it's silence and people like start talking about other things that don't relate to the class for a minute, and then they go back to the class.
Okay, all right. Well, next, let me say something about what's coming next week. So the rest of the semester, actually, is on the theory of history. Next week, we begin G.A. Cohen's book. In previous years, we began the semester with this book. I think I explained this at the very outset of the course. I decided to put it at the end this year because in previous years, there was always, among some students, the complaint that that book was just too hard to begin the semester with. They didn't have enough context for it. It is a difficult book. It's a extraordinary piece of scholarship. If you read it carefully, it's clear. What I would recommend for those of you who are less familiar with the kind of analytical philosophy writing that Cohen does is when you hit bits that are you're just finding hard and you can't quite get through, just soldier on rather than get stuck, because most of it will be quite clear. It's some books. Here's an overgeneralization, but one that I find useful. Some books are clearer when you read them quickly than when you read them carefully. Because when you read them carefully, you realize that there's all sorts of inconsistencies and sloppiness. But if you read it quickly, you get the general idea, and that is what's useful in the book. Other books are clearer the more carefully you read them. And that's because there's such care taken in every sentence by the writer to be sure that they are really meaning what they're saying in every sentence. Now, Cohen's book is at the extreme end of a book that is clearest when read carefully, and it's worth the expenditure of effort on it. I've only assigned a limited number of pages in it to try to keep it under control. It is a book that I would encourage you to read the whole thing outside of the class. Any other words of wisdom about Colin? You should know, you may not detect this when you read the book, he's incredibly funny. He was the funniest person I've known in my whole life. We will, I have a couple of hours of videos of him doing his comic routines, making fun of philosophers, and he has interviews with Marx, in which Marx is speaking with a Russian accent rather than a German accent, and the interviewer asks him, why speaking with a Russian accent? And he has this whole explanation about how the revolution opened in Russia, it was meant to open in Germany, but he treats it like a theater impresario. It's very funny. Anyway, he's very funny. Sometimes if you read something that's hard and you know that the person who wrote it is a really wonderful and humane and funny person, it'll give you a little more patience with the style of his work.
Have you read his last book?
The last book, what's it called? On Socialism? No.
Why Socialism?
It's basically the same as his article from New Left Review, Back to Socialist Basics, which is in the readings. It's a revision of that book. It's the shortest book ever written, as far as I can tell. It's about 60 pages, but very big, very small pages and very big type. And it's essentially the same as about a 20-page journal article.
They did the same thing for Aaron Frankfurt's Hot Bullshit. I think that was a precursor to this. This kind of set the stage for this one.
Oh, just a tiny little...
Yeah, just the same little...
Right,
little,
yeah. It's definitely a nice piece of work, though. It has this extraordinarily good exposition of the central values that a socialist economy is meant to achieve, and then why it's difficult to actually figure out institutions that could realize those values. So it's definitely a good book. Okay. See you next week.
Thank you.